Edward Kemp, thank you very much for agreeing to talk to Theatre Voice today. There are a number of reasons why we've invited you into the Theatre Museum to chat to you, the most pressing of which really is the revival of your adaptation of Nathan the Wise by Gotthold Ephraim Lessing, which was first seen at the Chichester Festival in 2003 and opens tonight at the Hampstead Theatre with a new cast. Could we almost go back to the beginning? This is a play that has not been seen, I gather, for over 100 years in the British stage, or maybe.
There is more. There was a production at the Mermaid Theatre by Bernard Miles in the 60s, but that, I think, might be the only production, certainly professional production ever, before ours in Chichester in 2003. What's remarkable about it is, you know, it was written in 1779. There are a lot of Victorian translations. It was a play which is, there are many, many English translations of it. It's not for want of translations it hasn't been done, but it's never quite caught light in some way. I think those translations might actually also be the problem.
So when did you come across this?
It partly came about, I mean, it was Stephen Pimlott who asked me to do it. I was aware of the play, I think probably thinking back, in my 20s I had a book of, you know, 1,000 great world plays, and I read through as many of them as I could get hold of, and I think probably that was when I read it, probably in a rather bad Victorian English translation. And beyond thinking, oh, it's about Jews, Muslims and Christians in Jerusalem, didn't really get it at all. But it sort of filed it away, and if you go to Germany at all, if you have any involvement in German theatre, which I do a bit, if you go to see plays in Germany, you will nearly always come across a production of Nathan the Wise somewhere. It is done endlessly in Germany, in a way that, you know, Shakespeare's plays are done endlessly here. So you kind of come aware, and it has quite interesting posters. I know there are a lot of English designers who have wanted to design this piece because they've seen posters with camels on. It's had a particular currency in England for about the last, I think since the early 80s, partly through a lot of British designers going to Germany and seeing these posters with camels on them, and an interest in European theatre, which began, renewed itself, I think, in the 80s, and also because of the world situation, a play which is about major religions trying to find a way of negotiating, getting on together in the crucible of world religions, i.e. Jerusalem, clearly had a sort of currency. And so I know the National Theatre talked about it in the late 80s. Whenever The Merchant of Venice was done at the RSC, Stephen Pimlott would try to do it there, because it's an interesting companion piece to The Merchant of Venice, because it's, you know, in simplistic terms, it has a good Jew compared to the bad Jew of The Merchant of Venice. But it never quite took off. And I think it never quite took off is that the idea is fantastic. You go to the play, and your heart dies. Actually, in about the second speech, when Nathan has this very, very long description of the journey from Babylon to Jerusalem, which is almost incomprehensible in every single English translation you encounter. So you give up. So it had been around. And when we were putting together our first season in Chichester, we were doing The Merchant of Venice. And so Stephen thought this might be the time, now he was running his own theatre and not at the mercy of other people, to strike. And so he gave it to me, and this was in the sort of autumn of 2002. So post-September the 11th, post-strikes on Afghanistan, or about the time of going to war with Afghanistan, when things were heating up. And so it felt like one really wanted to make it work. It felt like it one had to try and find a way in there, that it had become more urgent to be talking about these things. And if one could find a way of making this play work, then it was worthwhile doing. So I said to Stephen, yeah, I think I can do it. But it was slightly the blind leading the blind, in that I think at the point when I said that, I thought, well, there's a germ of an idea here, but how do you get to it? And then the next 6 months were an exploration of how you do that.
Can you perhaps explain, as it were, what, I mean, a little bit about what, I mean, I could rehearse what I think the play's about, not having seen it and having only read your version.
The story is about a wise Jew, a good Jew called Nathan, who is living in Jerusalem at the time of the Third Crusade. So Jerusalem is occupied by Saladin, the great Islamic warrior, born in Tikrit, the same place as Saddam Hussein, interestingly. And actually, it's a period of peace. There's a period of truce between the Crusaders and the Jihadis. And Nathan is getting on fine. Nathan is pursuing his life. He's living in this war zone. Very successfully, he's become very, very rich. And unfortunately, Saladin is a very profligate prince in Lessing's worldview, and needs money all the time. And so to be a rich man in an occupied city where the ruler needs money is not a good situation. And so Saladin calls in Nathan and puts to Nathan, as a means of tricking him, the question, which is the true faith, Islam, Christianity, or Judaism? And essentially the speech, the long speech, the story that Nathan tells in reply to that question, it was Lessing's reason for writing the play, and it takes a story from The Captive's Decameron about a man who had three sons and only one ring to give them, and then Lessing and Nathan do their own spin on the end of that story, which achieves this extraordinary enlightenment position of how are we going to go forward, how are we going to have a dialogue between these faiths. The second half, though, that's the interval. That's the first half of the play. The second half of the play puts that into operation. And Nathan himself gets caught up in a storyline entangled with his past and indeed Saladin's past, and a Knight Templar, a sort of Aryan hero who's wandering around Jerusalem having been pardoned by Saladin. And it's the entanglement of their lives and ends in a sort of a scene which is like a Shakespearean late romance. Of lost children being refound, and families being reunited, which in essence is only a practical application of the story of the Three Rings. So that's in outline the story. The problem is that twofold. It was the last thing that Lessing wrote. It came out of endless religious debates he'd been having with hardline kind of pastors in Germany, which a lot of which go back to an earlier play written called The Jews, which had dared to suggest that a Jew could be a good and considerate and kind person, which had got into terrible problems. And these rows went on for many, many years, and eventually Lessing's immunity from censorship was withdrawn because he got so passionate. So he could no longer write tracts. So he thought, well, I'll go back to writing plays, which is what he'd given up doing, and decided that he would pick up this story of the Three Rings and write a play based around it. So that was the starting point. For whatever reasons, possibly to give it a fable-like ambience, possibly to protect himself from censorship, he wrote it in verse. It's the only play of his he ever completed in verse. And although it sort of looks on the page a bit like Shakespearean blank verse, it's all over the place. He's trying to write. He writes very, very good prose in his other plays, very colloquial prose. He's trying to write a play which is in verse, but feels a bit like prose. People are endlessly interrupting each other and it gets broken up. So the moment you begin to put that into any other language, it's pretty hard to read in German. Any other language, if you try and follow that, you end up in huge problems, particularly when you've got Shakespeare standing over your shoulder who writes fantastic blank verse. So you have that problem of the verseness of it. Also, because he's writing from a polemical viewpoint, speeches that in any sensible play ought to stop after about 10 lines will go on for 25 lines. And so there's quite interesting, I mean, it's been interesting going back to the play at Hampstead. I'd forgotten how thriller-like the story is, how kind of switchback and twists and turns are in it. Actually, in the original, you barely get that because at the moment anything interesting is about to happen, somebody talks the next 10 minutes. So I guess the two problems that faced me were, one, what style did I write it in? Because it didn't feel to put it into it. Well, putting it into English blank verse seemed to have scuppered all of my some very illustrious predecessors. But also one had to get it down to manageable size, both because if you did the full text, I mean, nobody in Germany even does the full text, and they have a much greater appetite for long evenings in the theatre than we do. But it probably would run to 4.5 more hours. So one has to try and cut it down to size. And so what I began to do is condense. And interestingly, Schiller had been there before me. But the history of this play is that Lessing never saw it performed. He died after it had been published. It was not a great success when it was first performed. And then about 20 years after its first performances, in the early, it's about 1801, Goethe found it, and Goethe thought this is a great play, and handed it to Schiller and said, Schiller, cut this into shape and we'll do it. And they did, and that was how the play arrived in the German repertoire. Actually in Schiller's version. So I got Schiller's version out, and Schiller's version has some very useful cuts. So he was my first guide. Interestingly, in 1801, Schiller felt he had to cut an awful lot of the most anti-Christian stuff. So it's actually the anti-Christian feeling. It is tamed somewhat, which we've restored. He also cuts all the female characters pretty much to the bone, which seemed to be unfair, so I've restored them. But other than that, it was a useful guide for how one could begin to take the core of the arguments and get them down to something which is manageable. And because Schiller is, in his own way, a very fine polemical playwright's... Schiller is, in his own way, a very fine polemical playwright. He knows how to make an argument and keep a drama going. So that was my first starting point, was looking at Schiller's version, thinking, oh, well, that's interesting that he's done that, and I might use that, but I might not use that. And then trying to tackle this issue of the verse, quite late on in the proceedings, I stumbled... Because the problem is, you could just do it in colloquial prose, but it's a fable. It doesn't really work in the real world. It's deliberately a fable. It happens in a slightly fairy tale world, and one has to try and find some way of signalling that to the audience, but also one wants to make it current. One wants to make it feel alive of now. So I thought, well, maybe if one does the reversing does. So rather than writing verse, which is sort of trying to be prose, let's write some prose which is trying to be verse. And that seemed to be the key that unlocked all sorts of things unexpectedly. So that large chunks of it are written in iambic, but it's not the regular Shakespearean iambic pentameter goes dum-de-dum-de-dum-de-dum-de-dum. Mine will go di-dum-de-dum-de-dum-de-dum-de-dum-de-dum-de-dum-de-dum-de-dum. So it feels much more like prose, but actually there is a sort of pulse underlying it, and that seems to help, particularly in key moments, just to give it the lift that it needs. I mean, Tony Harrison talks about metre being literally like having a taxi running outside, and that you may not need it, but somebody else might at some point need to dash downstairs and get in the taxi and go off somewhere. And so there is a sort of metrical pulse in there. And that, which I wasn't expecting, began to free me up in terms of using a kind of elision, a way of people kind of picking up on other people's lines, running through things, jumping in on thoughts, which A, makes them all feel very clever, which they are, most of the characters in the play, because they all know what somebody's saying before they finish saying it. And they all begin to feel like they know each other. And that was also useful, because Lessing, it's quite an important part of the play that they are all quite familiar with each other. But Lessing's German is quite uninflected in terms of characterization. But it also meant that I could begin to kind of compress things. So my claim is, and it hasn't been disputed by anybody, that I don't think we've lost a single major thought from the original, but they're all compressed down, so that a thought that takes place across 25 lines does only take about 10 lines, and that seems to help keep the story going.
How did you manage to avoid succumbing to a sort of academic ennui when you? I mean, did you go through? Did you learn German? Did you have enough German to avoid sort of, I don't know, those nasty English translations or those unhelpful English translations?
Yeah, I mean, I have done translations and adaptations from languages I don't know, but I feel much happier doing French and German, which are the ones I have ready access to, and I always go through a process. Of the first thing I do, which nobody ever sees apart from me, is an absolutely literal translation of every single word that's on the page, pretty much in the order it happens. And I do that just to make sure that I've seen everything that's there at some point. It's kind of close reading. And I also do it as badly as possible to know how bad it could be. But I know that at that point, it's getting to know the thing. And then, quite often, I will put the German away, and I will now just look at this terrible English I have in front of me and try and turn it into speakable English, trusting that actually if I've done the work of the bad translation already, that the German is in there somewhere. And then it's simply a process of just trying to be a playwright, of just trying to take this thing and saying, okay, how can I express this thought in a way that is active in the scene, expresses character, is changing the other character in the space, is moving the story forward, you know, all the things that playwrights are trying to do all the time. So just try to be a playwright. And then sometimes if I get stuck in that process, I will pick up the German again and go back to it. But I've learnt... One of the earliest translations I did was a Molière, which we did for Leeds. And I did two Molières for Leeds. And the first one, which was The Hypochondriac, I tried to be quite faithful until I lost patience with it. And I lost patience with it in one great, enormous speech that one character has. And I remember sitting there in rehearsals with the French in front of me, listening to what this actor was saying, and thinking, gosh, what the actor's saying is rather good. And it's sort of nothing like the French in front of me, but sort of is. And I think that, for me, was my great lesson in terms of translating the spirit of something rather than the letter of it. And so the next Molière we did in Leeds, actually, I invented a language for, which was one of the successes of the piece, because Molière himself had invented a language. I didn't try to invent it. I took the notion of what Molière had done and turned it into a new form, fitting what we were doing. And so what I think of doing as a translator, as an adapter, is what I think of doing when I'm working as a dramaturg on a production, which is to try and understand what the writer was doing with the means available to him or her to connect this particular story, these ideas, to his or her audience. And I try to understand that as much as I can do, and then think, okay, well, I'm not that writer writing then. I'm me now, having to try to articulate these same things to my audience. What tools could I offer to you, Lessing, Molière, Racine, whoever it is, from our day that you might have been interested in? And sometimes that means that one, you know, in the case of Nathan, I also slightly restructured it, because there are certain expectations that audiences have now, which the play could very easily be made to fit. There's a lovely, lovely character called Al-Hafi, who Lessing himself was adored, and that he planned to write a sequel called The Dervish, is what Al-Hafi did. So Lessing loved Al-Hafi, so I knew that I was onto a good thing there. Al-Hafi disappears before the interval, and you think, oh, that's a bit sad. You know, you've just got to know this character, and he's gone. And I found, actually, he has three scenes in the original. If I cut his third scene in half, I could use the second half of it in the second half, actually at a much more interesting point in the story, for him to say goodbye to Nathan, which is what he's doing at that point. And that would satisfy a certain sense of symmetry for an audience today, particularly an English audience today, who have lived through Shakespeare in particular, whose late romances are all about kind of symmetry, that would make a lot of sense. So I did that, and then in other places where I felt like we could get a move on, I fused things together. And then a couple of places where, I mean, Lessing has this very strange theatrical style, which I rather like, but can be incredibly frustrating, in that great, 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 huge speeches, huge amounts of time will be taken to talk about intellectual ideas, and then extraordinarily life-changing things will happen in literally three lines. And if you can find actors who can do it, which in Chichester we did and in Hampstead they have done, it can be absolutely thrilling to see that in one moment somebody's whole world view changes. But it can be very scary, and it can be make the thing not entirely foolproof. So in one or two instances I have slightly unpackaged those very, very raw, compressed moments, just to give the actors a little bit more room to work with, but not much. But those are essentially saying to Gotthold, well, I have some sense of what an audience now will be expecting at this point, and I think I need to give them a little bit more than you've given them. But it's always trying to do it with an understanding of what he was trying to do in 1779.
Do you think there's an element to which the audiences are now more, because of, as you say, in the sense the commissioning happened after 9/11, it's been much remarked upon that audiences and indeed artistic directors et al. Are kind of hungry to explore the world that we now appear to be in, and therefore we can be forgiving towards Lessing even the best new version might still, as it were, contain the glitches or the awkwardnesses of that original, but in a way that's not the point, in a sense that you're rediscovering something and presenting it in a way that's going to catch the audience's imagination. I mean, do you think that's partly what's motoring it here as well, the audience's?
I think that's true. I mean, I sat through the first preview on Thursday night in Hampstead, which was like lots of first previews, a bit tentative, a bit uncertain, pulling in slightly odder directions, trying to find out how an audience might take this, because it is a strange beast. It's not like Shakespeare. It feels like it might be. It's not like Racine. It's not like Schiller. It's not. We don't have reference points for it. But you know, even in its kind of slightly raw version, then you felt like an audience wanted to hear this. That even where the actors didn't necessarily help them into a moment, the audiences were in that moment. So I'm sure that's right, that there is a readiness to hear these things. It's interesting, it's a tricky one in terms of the play because Lessing is an optimist, despite terrible things happening in his life, particularly at this point. I mean, he wrote this play having just lost his wife and his child. I mean, lost his wife almost in childbirth and the child shortly after. Within a matter of months before he started work on the play. So it is written out of particular personal grief, as well as he had a hard life himself. But he remains optimistic. It comes out of the Enlightenment. It's like Voltaire, because it doesn't have kind of Voltaire's cynical edge. He absolutely wants us to go towards the light. It's like the prisoner's chorus in Fidelio. That's the way at the end of the play. And so he, to a certain extent, buries a lot of the darkness. In a way that I'm not sure Schiller would have done. A romantic playwright, poet, probably wouldn't have done. They would have given us more of the darkness, more of the savagery. Actually, it's very, very buried in Lessing. And it's quite surprising when it suddenly emerges, and often very, very moving when it suddenly emerges. These lost stories, these terrible griefs that particularly Saladin and Nathan are nursing, that... You know, it's... I mean, in the case of Nathan, it's three-quarters of the way through the play. In the case of Saladin, it's halfway through the play before you actually learn what this burden they're both carrying is and what underlies the story. But the play ends in joy. And I think certainly in Chichester, what was interesting was that the first half, the story of the rings, the theory of how we should all negotiate together, and in some sense we are all part of the same family, which is the underlying story of the Three Rings. We are all brothers. The theory of that people had a fantastic time with. Whether they got the second half or not was essentially dependent on how optimistic or pessimistic they wanted to be about the world today. And you would find that actually very quickly, from people who hadn't got to the second half, you got into a conversation about the world today and their own political position, and a sense of pessimism, which I think Lessing would absolutely afford it, and say, no, actually the way forward is to remain optimistic, is to get beyond the darkness and head toward the light, in a way that's the time you're in, that's his philosophical background. And it's not a particularly current one today in many quarters.
I was going to say, in a way, because the further complicating strand of research that you might have had to do was to check up on Lessing's own suppositions about that period. I mean, however much it's a dramatic conceit and so forth, this very attractive notion that even in the teeth of the Third Crusade, there are areas of overlap, of understanding, of mutual cultural solidarity that at the moment, it seems, we can only park towards.
Lessing's history is better than Shakespeare's. I'll say that for him, in that he did research rather than just pick the one book off the shelf and dramatise it. And it's pretty accurate by what we know today. The relationship between Saladin and Richard the Lionheart, which is a minor strand of the play, is romanticised by Lessing as it's been romanticised by people through the ages. But... as far as anything I've read goes, it is historically pretty true that beyond ancient history, when Jerusalem did belong to the Jews, in terms of the history of that city, the periods when it was ruled by the Muslims, under some version of the Caliphate or by Saladin, have historically been some of the most peaceful in its history. And Saladin did open up the sacred sites both to Christians and Jews. Now, that's not to say that there weren't terrible things happening on the ground, because there always are. And indeed, the play begins with Nathan's house having had a fire, been set alight to. And we never know what that's about. And over again in the course of the play, people talk about the lay brother has had his shrine beaten up, and he's been beaten up, and his shrine's been busted open by some Arab youths, and he talks about the time of reprisal. So clearly, as always through history, even in times of peace, people are having a hard time. But I think he is right in saying that at that particular moment in the bloody history of Jerusalem, there was a moment of peace. Now, whether there is any useful model for us today, I suspect that handing over Jerusalem to any kind of Muslim leadership is not going to be the way forward today. I don't know. It's hard to say that there is a kind of a direct contemporary political lesson to be taken from the play in that sense. But it does seem like he did find a moment in history which even contemporary Arab historians today and Christian and Judaic historians will accept was a moment of calm in amongst the many storms. It's interesting that the way people interpret the play's message, because some people will say that the message of the play is that we are all one family, as I have said, that we are all brothers, that in essence all this religious stuff is superficial. And actually, I'm not sure the play does say that. That it is held out, there is a possibility when the final judge comes in the story of the rings, that he will say there is one true ring and the other two are fakes. And Hannah Arendt, the East German Jewish historian philosopher, wrote a rather wonderful book in the 60s called Men in Dark Times, and one of the people she chooses is Lessing. And her view is that Lessing's view is that we should not ignore who we are, that we should accept that somebody is a Jew, somebody is a Muslim, somebody is a Christian, and bind to them more strongly because of that. That there is a line in the play when Nathan finally tells his grief, that the lay brother, the Christian lay brother who has just heard this story, says, "Nathan, you are a Christian, a greater Christian never lived." And Nathan replies, "What makes me a Christian to you makes you a Jew to me." And in some sense, that there is actually at the core of these things important values which are important to hold on to, but that in order to hold on to those, there is no requirement that you should cease to be a Jew, he should cease to be a Muslim, I should cease to be a Christian, whatever. That we should hang on to those beliefs, because they are our tradition, they are what we've drunk in with our mother's milk, but we should be open-eyed about the prejudice that has given us, and we should seek to make connections with other religions and understand them, but not in a way that says, and now you will have to stop being Jews.